Welcome to Reality Check, a weekly podcast about anything and everything having to do with education. I'm Jeannie Allen. I'm the CEO and founder of the Center for Education Reform, where we've been working for almost 25 years to expand education opportunity and innovation. Reality Check is a production of National Review. I hope you all will subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn so that every week you'll be sure to get the latest Reality Check podcast delivered right to your computer. You're listening to another edition of Reality Check. I'm Jeannie Allen. I'm so happy to have you today with me, with this special guest, who I have been a huge fan of ever since I woke up one morning, opened the Wall Street Journal opinion piece, and read about Erica Komisar's work and her book, Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. I was so struck by her argument that I immediately reached out, and she got back to me right away, and this is the culmination of us having connected. Just goes to show you why you should actually read your paper and not pick it up later. Erica's been in private practice for the last 25 years. She's incredibly well-educated, graduate of Georgetown, Columbia, and has been part of workshops and seminars for corporations and childcare settings, and she's the mom of three teens as well. So, Erica, thank you so much for joining me here.
Thank you for having me.
It is so fitting that we're taping this episode for our listeners almost right after Mother's Day, but I guess in a way every day is Mother's Day, which would kind of explain why you wrote your book. Talk a little bit about what precipitated that.
Well, I wrote the book because I, as a parent guidance expert and a psychoanalyst, I was seeing this increasing epidemic of mental disorders in very young children, meaning very young children were being diagnosed earlier and earlier and medicated earlier for things like ADHD and early signs of aggression and anxiety and depression. And as a clinician, I was really becoming concerned. So I started looking at the research, the neuroscience research and the epigenetics research, as well as the attachment research, which backed up what I was seeing, which was that the absence of mothers in children's lives on a daily basis may have been contributing to some of these mental disorders.
And, you know, it goes without saying that I'm sure you've heard from lots of people, but those of us who were out of the home fairly soon after our kids were born are like, oh my gosh, what did I do? And so, of course, the tremendous guilt out there that you immediately feel. But in a way, many of us always knew that, right? That your child needs you, and we feel that tug. What does the science say about today's generation of kids versus, let's say, those of our mother's generation? Is there a difference? Is this truly something that we can isolate? And if so, what's the solution?
Well, first I want to address what you just really made a very important point, which is that mothers have been feeling stressed now for over 2 generations. And when mothers are stressed, meaning guilt is a form of stress, then you know babies are stressed. So babies and mothers are a couple, really, if you think about it. And when mothers feel guilty and are stressed, so are babies. So what we're really seeing is stress disorders. And we're seeing stress disorders in very young children. And then we're seeing stress disorders in adolescents and young adults. And remember, those young adults then become adults. And so, you know, the increase in mental illness in our country is epidemic. I mean, so we see an increase in depression and anxiety overall. But if you think about the origin, and people don't like to think about the origin of depression and anxiety, but what we say is in the first 3 years, which is what I write about in this book, that is the foundation for emotional security, emotional regulation, and resilience to stress. So that's where the ability to cope with stress comes from.
So this is interesting on so many levels. I mean, I hear, as I'm sure you do on a regular basis, friends saying, you know, their kids are in college, they've had to go pick them up because they're not handling the stress. I mean,
Right. They're
not finishing. I've had a show with people about higher education and the trouble with completion, and there's many, many issues, but some of them are people are not prepared to finish.
Right.
We're hearing more and more of parents having to engage with their students when some of us just went and we're like, oh my gosh, I'm so here and I'm so independent, and we just handled it.
Right.
Erica.
Right. Well, so we had more resilience to stress. I agree with what you're saying completely, that the kids today don't have the kind of resilience to stress that they need to cope with an increasingly challenging society. So to say that it's a more challenging and more competitive and more aggressive world that we live in is an understatement. And so that makes a more emphatic argument for the idea of why it's really important that we give our children a foundation in the very beginning as much as possible for that kind of emotionally secure foundation so then they can cope with the stress for life.
And so your recommendations, your central theme, the more is more, the more time you spend with your child, especially those first years, the better. In fact, that you even, I believe, said you should consider staying home with your child for the first 3 years.
Yeah, and you know what I say in the book is it's really not a book about working versus not working, even though it's gotten confused in that way because of the title. It's really a book about more is more. So there are a lot of mothers who have to work, and that's a reality. And I think the word prioritizing children is really the key there, meaning maybe in those first 3 years, that isn't the time to emphasize or prioritize or be overly ambitious with your work. Maybe that's a time to treat your work as secondary and your children as primary, and that helps you to make different decisions about your work if you are going to work. And for those people who can take time off, again, we're a society that gives no paid maternity leave, so I say we're the most uncivilized country in the world in many ways. So because we give no paid maternity leave, you know, take off as long as you can. And then prioritizing may mean reorganizing what your work means to you in those first 3 years. Again, we have a long life. We can do it all. We just can't do it all at the same time.
But I imagine there were an awful lot of people who first read about your book and heard you on different media or saw what you wrote or were interviewed in and wanted to jump all over you.
Yeah.
I bet there were an awful lot of feminists who said, oh my gosh, who's this woman? How dare she? You are not just though kind of, you're not a conservative, right?
I mean, I consider myself, how should I say this? I consider myself a feminist because for me, the definition of feminism is that we've been given choices and our choices are, you know, that we can work or have children, but, you know, having choices comes with a great amount of responsibility. So if having choices means that we can choose our own needs over our very small children, that isn't my version of feminism. My version of feminism is we have many choices, and we don't all have the same choices, right? Again, some women don't have the same choices as others financially or economically. But we all have some choices, even if that choice is who's going to care for our children or how we think about child care or what kind of position we take in those early years that allows us to be home the maximum amount of hours. You know, so we all have some choices. To me, that's feminism. Feminism is making good choices based on good information.
You know, you remind me, it's an interesting connection also, the strand to another fabulous woman I interviewed, Leonore Scanese, mm-hmm. who started Free Range Kids. Mm-hmm. And we had the discussion about kids not being able to have their own agency, be outside that without being monitored, that we've lost this ability to let kids be free. And that contributes to this stress later on as well. They don't know how to be independent. They don't know how to take care of themselves. And so I'm sure that at the heart of what you're seeing in young kids, students, adolescents, and so on is also partially, do you think, related to that?
Well, interestingly, so I'll put on my psychoanalyst hat for just a second and say that
please.
What's critical is healthy attachment and healthy separation. And what happens today is that mothers are spending so much time away from their children, either because they can't help it or they want to, and it makes them feel guilty. And so what happens is when it comes to separation, they have a very hard time. So funny enough, it can intensify a kind of intrusiveness, a kind of, I don't want to call it attachment, I would say anxiety about children. Because when you feel guilty as a parent because you're not there enough, then you can become increasingly anxious, and then you don't allow for separation. So you'd say it backfires in a funny way.
Well, I'm sure that you are used to armchair psychologists, mm-hmm. but I just remember you know, when I had my babies, and my mother would say things like, you don't have to play with them all the time, just give them the Tupperware and let them just be with them. And in a way, that was a very natural thing for me to hear. And I know it was sort of a natural thing for lots of parents, but there's so many people who think if you're not actually with your child doing what they're doing, that somehow you're not being a great mother.
Again, you can't be with your child every moment, and even if you're physically with them, you can't emotionally be with them every single moment. But the idea is to be there physically enough and emotionally present enough that they feel secure. So Margaret Mahler, a very famous psychoanalyst, said children need to go back and forth with what she called emotional refueling in the first 3 years to be emotionally secure in the long run. And that means that they need to explore the world but be able to come back to their primary care object to be reassured to go back out into the world and explore. That is the process by which children become emotionally secure and more independent. And if the mother isn't there, then they're not able to do that kind of emotional refueling.
All right, so I'm totally sold, and I want to help figure this out. What? How do we accomplish this in a world where 70% of moms work outside the home, and more women are delaying even having children until they're well into their career, which makes it even more difficult for them than at that point? What do we want to say? Are there policies? You mentioned maternity leave. We have fought about that before in Washington. We've seen that a million times. In fact, I remember when I was first cutting my teeth in Washington, the big thing was let's pay for more daycare. It wasn't to help moms stay home.
Right.
It was to help them get out of the house.
Mm-hmm. I just came back from Sweden where I was speaking because in Sweden they have the issue of enforcing daycare on women after a year, which basically doesn't give women choices to stay home. So you're right. The government, if anything, is pushing daycare. And daycare, as we know, is not the best child care option. For me, the solution is really advocating for women to be entrepreneurial. I mean, we know that many women can't be, but many women can. And to think about maybe think outside the box about either choosing professions where they have control and flexibility, or if they work within companies, setting up that control and flexibility. You know, there are many jobs within corporations that can be entrepreneurial, where women have more control and flexibility. But I would say as a mother, that's key, is to have as much control and flexibility in your work as possible.
Well, and I think this the ability with technology today to be able to be remote, you have to prove yourself that you can do it first. You know, I remember having to actually go to one of my first bosses and say, I want to stay home for 6 months when I have my child. And they said, no, that's never been done. I go, yeah, well, I'm going to do it. No, that you can't do that. I said, no, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to show you it can be done, right? And then I had to do it for the second kid and for the third kid, and they got pretty tired of me at that point. And that was early, and there's no reason that can't happen. And to your point about being entrepreneurial, oh my gosh, you could teach online. You can do so many things that you couldn't do before, and you can also be at the top of your game. It does just take some additional thought. What did you mean by your term wormhole to adolescence in your book?
So what happens in infancy and toddlerhood happens again in adolescence. That's an oversimplification, but it is sort of true, in that the brain is organizing and reorganizing in a similar way in adolescence to the way it did when children were infants and toddlers. And that means you have another opportunity to make a difference. In fact, the book that I'm writing now is on adolescence because it's what we call the second period of critical brain development, the first being 0 to 3, because we know by the age of 3, 85% of a child's right or social-emotional brain is developed. But we know that there's a reorganizing of that social-emotional brain in adolescence. And adolescence is really from 9 to 25 now. It begins earlier and ends later. So we have this big window as parents in which to make a difference in our children's social-emotional development that we didn't really know we had, meaning because of neuroscience, we can actually see the brain and know that we have another opportunity, either to repair what we didn't do in 0 to 3 or to have another opportunity to make a difference.
And give us some examples about how you would do that, particularly the sort of the adolescent to 25. Again, these parents are picking up their kids, and so distraught. What did I do wrong? What happened? Why is he depressed? Why is she socially distraught? Why is she so stressed? Why can't she do her work? I mean, just the number of stories you hear on a regular basis. I'm sure people listening right now have had this happen to them, if not someone else. How do they go about helping kind of fuse that those neurons, if you will, back so it's more stable?
Yeah, what happens to us developmentally as parents when our children become adolescents and late adolescents and young adults is that we feel our children need us less. And often parents even feel rejected by their children who seem to need more independence. And those parents then don't understand that children need you almost as intensely, just in a different way. And so that need is expressed differently. But what we do as parents is we'll often, at that point that our children are adolescents, we'll go off and be less available to them because we feel they don't need us. In fact, they need us almost as intensely as they did in infancy and toddlerhood. And so for parents who may pick up their children at college who are really struggling with anxiety, those children actually may need to do a little bit of regression. And that regression isn't permanent, but they may actually need to get something. So the analogy that I use is if you sit at a dinner table and you didn't eat enough and you walk away from the table, then you're hungry and you say, I need to go back to the table and get something more to eat. And that's what those children often need to do, is they need actually that little bit of regression. Remember I said the emotional refueling. It means they're not done. They're not cooked developmentally. And even though they may look like adults, inside they're not emotionally developed in the same way that they look physically developed.
And is there anything we can be doing as well through schooling and education that can support this process either early on or later? So, for example, you know, that which you're sharing, Erica, about what we know more about the brain than we ever did, we're also realizing that you're not done at third grade just because you didn't learn to read, that you actually are much more malleable. We just have to provide different experiences and different access points. We also have to understand what you didn't get the first time around.
Yeah.
Is there some emotional sort of connections or other things the schools we can be doing with schools? I shouldn't say the schools should be doing, because the schools shouldn't be doing any of this stuff, frankly. But what's the environment? What's the best environment for students in schools? Is it to have more experiential, more independence?
Mm-hmm.
Is it to have you know, we talk about longer day, longer year,
yeah,
because our kids aren't getting educated enough. Maybe that's not the right answer.
Well, actually, the right answer is to focus on, the way I would describe it is social-emotional development before cognitive development is like putting on your socks before you put on your shoes. So, you know, we've developed into a society that overvalues cognitive development. And what that means is that we often push cognitive development in schools very, very early, and while not really thinking about the social-emotional development first, meaning there's a lot of anxiety that if we focus on social-emotional development, we'll never get to the cognitive development. And in fact, you'd say the social-emotional development sets the foundation for the cognitive development. So we say right brain development before left brain development, because to learn, you have to tolerate a lot of frustration. And what happens is, if you don't have the social-emotional development, the resilience to stress and the emotional regulation underneath you, when it comes to learning and the frustration, the house of cards collapses at some point. And it either collapses in third grade, it'll collapse in adolescence, or it'll collapse in college. So a lot of kids are holding it together until they get to college. And then the frustration and the stress is too much, and they don't have that social-emotional development under them to support them. So I would say in schools to focus more on social-emotional development in the first few years, knowing that the cognitive development is going to develop. It will come. That would be my recommendation.
Well, you're going to be popular with a lot of people out there. I mean, that is a huge hot-button issue today. The Aspen Institute has been developing research on this. Mark Shriver's involved with them on it. We just heard the First Lady talking about the emotional development of students and kids. And there's this struggle, though, right? Because there are people who are saying, and as you know, you would expect, well, we have to allow kids to learn. We don't want to go back to a point either when the nation was declared at risk back in the 80s. You know, our decline in education in this country – part of it was we weren't rigorous. Part of it was we weren't going deep enough with education. And part of it was adult behavior saying, oh, we want to just care about the kids and be nice. It wasn't social emotional development in the sense of really training. I mean, what you're saying is something that has to be trained in our educators and the people around our kids in schools, right? It's not just, oh, come in, let me give you a hug.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a part of it that's about emotional sensitivity, but it's much more than that. And again, I think it is an anxiety that this society has, that modern society has, that our children won't learn if we focus on social-emotional development first. And in fact, all the research says the opposite, that when children have a good foundation of social-emotional development, they actually are better learners. They absorb more, and they have more tolerance to frustration in the long run. And we need to be able to tolerate frustration to learn.
You know, I think this is enormously positive and great news, truly, for people who are struggling themselves with wondering what went wrong, as well as for men and women considering having kids or have small children now. I mean, there's just so much here to tease out, Erica, that there's things that you can repair if things have gone wrong, and there's ways to resolve to do things differently to go forward. And so hats off to you for stepping forward and coming out with what could have been a pretty controversial book, but it sounds like you're traveling a lot and people are really enjoying listening to you. Tell us the most exciting group or the most interesting group you've spoken to.
Well, interestingly, I've been speaking a lot in Europe. So I've spoken to policymakers in Great Britain and the UK and also in Sweden, and have been asked to come to other European countries. And I would like to speak more to policymakers here, but unfortunately, there is not the same kind of openness here as there is in other countries. And, as I say, we don't really understand or value nurturing as a great force in developing the social-emotional brain of children. And we don't really respect the value of what mothers and fathers do in terms of developing citizens going forward. And I think that's a problem in this country. But I would say my most exciting experiences were speaking in Swedish Parliament and speaking to members of Parliament in England at the Legatum Institute. And, those have been very exciting things for me.
Well, I think it's fantastic, and I hope that maybe we can help you be talking to policymakers here. This body of work you have done could help us solve some of these pernicious problems we're seeing with students and our babies all across the country. So thank you so much for joining me today on Reality Check, Erica.
Thank you, Jeannie.
I've been talking to Erica Komisar and her work, Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. That's just one of her books. She's working on another one. She has been a psychologist, psychological consultant. She has counseled lots of other countries. So, hey, folks, let's have her counsel ours out there. You can follow her work and learn more at Komisar.com. She's on LinkedIn and Facebook and at Twitter, Erica Komisar, CSW. And don't forget, stay up to date with us and CER and Jeannie Allen, A Reality Check for a great show every week. Thank you again for listening to me so much and to listening to these great shows. For Reality Check, I'm Jeannie Allen. Reality Check is produced by National Review and posted at nationalreview.com in association with CER, the Center for Education Reform. If you like what you heard in this podcast, and I hope you did, you might want to subscribe for free to make sure you don't miss any future programs. Please sign up at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or TuneIn. I'm Jeannie Allen.